So my name is Ilanka Dunnan. My day job is that I make computer games. I also have various hobbies. One of those hobbies is that I crack codes. I've cracked some codes that I found here at DragonCon and in the hacker scene. And I got interested in the Knights Templar through that code experience. It actually all kind of starts here at DragonCon. So just as a quick story, I was here at DragonCon several years ago speaking about games, and then I would meet other speakers in the same track, like the hackers that would come in and talk about computer security. And through them, I heard about this code, the Freaknik code, that it had been a year and no one had cracked it yet. So I went and took a look at it. I got the flyers with all the other stuff you pick up around DragonCon, and I cracked that code. I got a free trip to a HackerCon and free hotel, drinks, T-shirts, and then I went around cracking a bunch of other codes. Actually cracked so many codes, I've actually been banned from competition in the hacker scene. So at the AtlantaCon HackerCon, when they released their code on a sheet of paper, at the bottom of the paper it said, "Note, past puzzle crackers are ineligible for prizes associated with solving the AtlantaCon puzzle. Give someone else a chance, Ilanka." So I cracked that one too. And did other cryptography-related things. When September 11th happened, I was as enraged as everyone else by what had happened, and so I volunteered to help out with the war on terrorism and was going around giving talks about what kinds of codes that Al-Qaeda was using, what kind of codes that they weren't using. And so this cryptography thing kept growing and growing, and one of the places that I was invited to speak was at the Central Intelligence Agency, where they have this sculpture called Kryptos. It's a sculpture with codes on it. It's a challenge to the employees at the CIA. There are four codes on it. Three of the four have been solved. The fourth has not been solved yet. It's one of the most famous unsolved codes in the world. And I am kind of the world's number one expert on Kryptos. So I have this discussion group where we're talking about this fourth part of Kryptos. So in 2003, here's where the Dan Brown connection comes in. And then that kind of leads to Knights Templar. 2003, people started coming to me and saying, what's the connection between Kryptos and the Da Vinci Code? And I was like, what's the Da Vinci Code? I hadn't heard of the book at that point. And who here has read the Da Vinci Code? Just, okay. So anyone who's looked at this particular edition of the book, you may have noticed that hidden in the artwork of the book jacket, there's actually puzzles hidden in the artwork. And for example here, and you can't really see it, but very faintly light red on dark red, there are latitude and longitude coordinates, which point to CIA headquarters near the location of Kryptos. And what Dan Brown was doing is he was giving clues to the subject of his next novel. And how many people here have read The Lost Symbol? Okay, so Kryptos, this sculpture at CIA, does feature, it does have a part in The Lost Symbol, and so I helped Dan Brown with some of the research for the book. He actually named one of the characters in the book after me. So if you've read it, what he does is he scrambles names. So like his editor's name is Jason Kaufman, and in the book there's an editor named Jonas Falkman, and my name is Ilanka, and in the book there's a character named Nola Kay, so that's an anagram for Ilanka, and she's like this information person that gets information and sends information, which is very much me as I was helping Dan with the research for the book. So as I was kind of learning more and doing research, and I read Da Vinci Code, and there was so many weird things in it, kind of pseudo-history, and I went out and started doing research for myself on what was fact and what was fiction, especially about the Knights Templar. I went on Wikipedia and I read the article about Knights Templar, and it was not a very well-written article, and so I completely overhauled the article and rewrote it from top to bottom, and now when you go on Wikipedia, it's a very factual, very thorough article about Wikipedia and about the Knights Templar, and it's actually achieved what's called featured status on Wikipedia, and I arranged for that article about the Knights Templar to be on the front page of Wikipedia on October 13th, 2007, which was the 700-year anniversary of the date that the Templars were arrested. And I'll be going into more of that. So what I'm trying to do in this talk is kind of summarize some of that information for you guys, talk about what's said about the Templars, kind of the rumors, especially from the Da Vinci Code, and kind of separate the fiction from the fact so you can all kind of get a sense of what the reality is. Okay, so there's legends, lots and lots of legends about Knights Templar. They've been in popular culture. They talk about, you know, there's Rosalind Chapel, there's Foucault's Pendulum, there's Monty Python and the Holy Grail, there's computer games, Assassin's Creed. Templars are just kind of referred to everywhere. And the Templars are often associated with the Holy Grail as well. And so I'll be talking a little bit about the Holy Grail and how some of the legends of that have come around. Then Baphomet is another image that's been associated with the Templars. And it's kind of sad because you can actually like watch a National Geographic documentary and they'll show these images of Templars standing around worshiping this image of Baphomet. I'm hearing, is this me? And we have musical accompaniment. But this image of Baphomet was actually not drawn until the 1800s, whereas the Templars were disbanded in the 1300s. But somehow it all kind of started getting mushed together, and today people lose track of when a legend was added to the history of the Knights Templar, and they think that, oh, well, this must go all the way back to the 1300s, when it doesn't. It was created centuries afterwards by someone who was kind of just expanding on the stories. The Shroud of Turin is also something that's sort of associated with the Templars, but it actually does have a real connection with the Templars, and I'll go into that. In the Louvre in Paris, if you go into their Hall of Crusades, there are also legends about the Templars. This is an enormous painting that's in the Hall of Crusades in the Louvre. It's called Jacques Molay Takes Jerusalem. Jacques Molay was the last Grand Master of the Templars, and it shows this great battle scene. However, in actuality, there was no such battle. Jacques de Molay was never in Jerusalem. It's complete fiction, because what happened in the 1800s, there were some popular playwrights. Sort of the Dan Brown of the 1800s was writing plays where he would kind of add into the fiction when the Templars did this and the Templars did that. And Jacques de Molay was, you know, coordinated with the Mongols, and they put together an army and they went and they took Jerusalem during the Crusades. And the king kind of liked this story of Jerusalem being retaken, so commissioned this grand painting about this battle, but it never happened. But so the Templars are just kind of connected with all sorts of different things. They're a very romantic idea. So, Da Vinci Code. So, at the very beginning of the book, there's this thing that says, all descriptions of artwork, architecture, documents, and secret rituals in this novel are accurate. No, they are not. Okay. Dan was often inspired by different things in history, but he did not get them right. Even such a thing as driving down a street in Paris and say, and then I would turn right. Well, in actuality, if you're on that street, you should turn left if you're trying to get to the certain area. So very, very basic things that he was just really going for a storytelling thing. He wasn't trying to portray accurate information. And he was really inspired in large part, not entirely, but in large part, by the work of another Michael Bagent, Richard Lee, and Henry Lincoln, who wrote a book called Holy Blood, Holy Grail. It came out in the early 1980s, and they talked about some ideas that they put together about maybe Mary Magdalene and Jesus got together and had a kid. And so when Dan Brown read this, he was like, this could be turned into a good novel. The problem, though, is that Holy Blood, Holy Grail, even though it was not a work of fiction, it was a work of what's called pseudo-history. So the authors there were kind of taking some facts, and they would have point X and point Y, and they wouldn't know what happened in between, so they'd kind of make it up as something that likely happened. And further, when they did their research, some of the people that they were talking to for their research were active fraudsters and hoaxers who were actively trying to mislead. So the authors of Holy Blood and Holy Grail took this information thinking it was true, but it wasn't, and then they would put it into the book, and then that continued to expand the problem here. So the whole Priory of Sion, where they say, in Holy Blood, Holy Grail, they say, these are facts that we know are true. And one of the facts that they say in Holy Blood, Holy Grail is fact. The Priory of Sion is a real organization that was founded in 1099 and had a series of grand masters, including Leonardo da Vinci. That is not a fact. That was a man named Pierre Plantard in the 1950s who was perpetrating a hoax because he was trying to get himself declared king of France. So he made up this elaborate genealogy and this elaborate thing about the Priory of Sion that was maintaining this long line of historical documents, and he made up a list of grand masters, and then he forged documents to look like they were medieval documents and hid them in two places. He hid one set of medieval documents in the Bibliothèque Nationale de France, France, the French National Library, and he hid another set of documents in a book that was about another part of France. In southern France, there's this tiny town called Rennes-le-Château. And Rennes-le-Château is sort of ground zero for all conspiracy theories in France. It's like their version of Roswell, okay? Or Area 51, okay? And anytime there's UFOs or conspiracy theories or hidden treasure, it's all going to come back to, well, maybe it has something to do with Rennes-le-Château. So Pierre Plantard hired someone named Gérard de Sède to write a book about Rennes-le-Château, about the history of Rennes-le-Château. And in this book, which is called Les Trésors Maudits de Rennes-le-Château, in this book, they hid they printed pictures saying, well, look, a priest in the 1800s was renovating a church and found these medieval documents. Here, we're reprinting them in the book. So it made it look like these were real. But in actuality, the whole thing was forgeries. So the Holy Blood, Holy Grail, they saw this book. They saw these medieval documents that were in the book. They'd been lost. The actual documents didn't exist anymore, of course. So the only copies left were in this book. And so they took those as fact, and then they continued to expand, and Dan Brown continued expanding from there. So according to Da Vinci Code, and I've got this in italics because it's according to Da Vinci Code, the Priory of Sion was supposedly founded in 1099, had a series of secret grandmasters, including Leonardo da Vinci over the years, and the Priory of Sion founded the Knights Templar. And supposedly documents verifying the priory, they were found in this French church in Rennes-le-Château in the 1800s by a priest named Béranger Saunière. Okay, so that's many people think, oh, that's what happened with the Knights Templar. No basis in reality. There was no Priory of Sion. Knights Templar were found in a completely different way. But because Dan Brown said it, a lot of people started believing it. So the reality, non-italics, okay. In reality, they were warrior monks. What happened is the First Crusade, when Jerusalem was taken, one of the veterans of the First Crusade, a man named Hugh de Payon, who came from northeastern France, he noticed that though the city was under control, the area around Jerusalem was not under control. And it was kind of a sad thing that after Jerusalem was captured, all these European pilgrims were like, oh, you know, the Christians are in control of Jerusalem now. I want to go visit Jerusalem. So they'd go down to southern Europe and they'd get on ships and they'd come across ships and they'd go to Israel. They'd put into port there, and then Jerusalem is not a port city. It's an inland city. So these pilgrims are trekking overland to get to Jerusalem, and the bandits are just taking over. They're slaughtering the pilgrims, sometimes hundreds at a time. It was a very, very dangerous journey. So Hugh de Payon went to the king of Jerusalem, King Baldwin of Jerusalem, and said, how about if we put together a monastic order that will protect these pilgrims that are going back and forth to the port? And it was a very radical idea at the time, because monks were considered to be men of peace. And the idea that there would be monks who would be carrying weapons, this idea of warrior monk, was extremely controversial, extremely radical. But King Baldwin liked the idea, and he authorized them to set up a headquarters on the Temple Mount. And I'll show you a picture of this. And that's where they took their name, the Knights Templar, Knights of the Temple in Jerusalem. And then eventually things just started growing and growing and growing from there, because people liked this idea of warrior monks. They got some powerful supporters in the church, and then the Pope formally blessed them. Then they became a favored charity. They were an officially sanctioned by the Pope charity. And so everyone in Europe that wanted to help out with the Crusades, and they wanted to give it to a charity where they knew the money was going to be used properly, where they were giving money to the Knights Templar. So that's where you have this thing about people were donating money, they were donating their lands, you know, huge tracts of land. That's where this comes from, right? You know, and that's what people were doing. And they were also their noble-born sons. They were saying, here, join the Templar order. So this order just kept growing and growing and growing, and really kind of became multinational. It was really kind of the world's first multinational corporation. They funded many building projects all around the Holy Land. There were forts up and down, what was Palestine, and then the island on the left there, that's a little bit of Cyprus. So after the Crusades were not doing so well, and the Muslims were coming in and had gotten more organized, were kicking the Christians off the continent, the Christians eventually grouped together and retreated, and then they set up base on the island of Cyprus and tried to launch some more raids from Cyprus onto the Holy Land. This is Hugh de Payon, it was just him and six or seven of his relatives, all kind of coming from that area of northern France, and tried to just create this small order. So their first headquarters was not in this particular building, but this is one of the most recognized buildings in the world, on the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. This is actually a mosque, and this this mountain, the Temple Mount or the Noble Sanctuary, depending on which religion you're talking to, how it's named, is sacred in three different religions. It's sacred to the Jews, it's sacred to the Christians, it's sacred to the Muslims, and so it keeps changing hands depending on, you know, who's in control of the area. There's a rough peace right now, but it keeps changing hands a lot. So when the Crusaders went in, at that point it had been controlled by the Muslims, so the Muslims had built these mosques. And the Crusaders then they didn't tear the mosque down, they then used these mosques for their own use. And so they would use this mosque, the Knights Templar were in one of the mosques, and King Baldwin, his palace, was in another of the buildings there. And the Crusaders believed that the mosques were built on top of what had been the Temple of Solomon. And the Temple of Solomon was where supposedly the Ark of the Covenant was kept. It was where the sacrifices from the Bible supposedly occurred. And so all of this, since they thought that it was built on top of the Temple of Solomon, that's why they called themselves the Knights of the Temple. So the Knights Templar. This kind of shows the whole thing in context. So the dome, called the Dome of the Rock, the Muslims believe that from this location, Muhammad, in about the 7th century, had been asleep in Mecca, and then in the winged steed, the Buraq, came to him. It's called the lightning steed in Muslim mythology. I shouldn't say mythology, but in Muslim custom, the Buraq. And it's sort of almost like a Pegasus-like creature. It's a white kind of a horse with the face of a woman, and it travels as fast as lightning. And anytime you go into the stories of the Quran or the earlier stories of Islamic tradition, they talk, and the prophets needed to travel from one place to another, they always traveled on a Buraq. And actually, the current airlines, it's like Al Buraq Airlines. It's based on these original traditions, right? And it's a beautiful, beautiful story. And the children, they have festivals for children, Islamic festivals for children, and this is one of the stories that they tell about how Muhammad was asleep, and then the Buraq came to him and took Muhammad to a place that wasn't specified. It was just the farthest mosque. And there Muhammad dismounted from the Buraq, and he prayed for a while, and then he mounted the Buraq again, and the Buraq took him up into heaven. And in heaven, Muhammad met many of the prophets. He met Moses. He met Jesus. He went all the way up, and he spoke to God. And God told Muhammad to go back to earth and to tell everyone that they must pray 50 times a day. So Muhammad comes back through the circles of heaven. As he's coming down, Moses takes him aside and says, "What did God tell you?" And Muhammad, it's a wonderful story. And Muhammad tells him all this, and Moses says, 50 times a day. And Muhammad said, they won't do it. They won't do it. Go back. Ask for a reduction. So Muhammad goes back up to God and says, 50 times a day is too much. And so they come back, and Moses said, "No, too much, too much. Go back." So they go back and forth, finally reduce it down to 5 times a day. And then Muhammad comes back, and he comes back in the Buraq and touches ground, and then goes back to Mecca, and then communicates all of his conversations. And the story is called the Isra and Miraj, and it's the basis of some of the stories that are in the Quran. So the Muslims, this thing about where is the farthest mosque, there's been great debate. Just like in Christianity, we have great debates about where exactly was the location of the crucifixion, where exactly was the place in Bethlehem. We have kind of good guesses, but we don't know specifically. So the same thing with Islamic tradition, where exactly did Muhammad go? And it's generally believed today that he went to the Temple Mount, and there's a rock there called the Dome, which is where the Dome of the Rock is, where they believe that's where Muhammad set foot before he went up into heaven. So that's why that particular location is so revered within the Islamic religion. Any of you that have heard of the Wailing Wall for the Jewish tradition, that's right about here. And they're praying towards the wall, and it's again related to the Temple of Solomon. As for where the Ark of the Covenant was, you know, we're kind of guessing, but we're thinking that it was probably right around here on the Temple Mount. This mosque is called the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and that means the farthest mosque. And now, it was not there at the time that Muhammad visited. When Muhammad visited, if he visited there, this was all just basically bare. However, after the Muslims captured this area, like about 50-100 years later, they built a mosque there, and they called it Al-Aqsa Mosque, the farthest mosque, based on that story about Muhammad went to the farthest mosque. But there's people today who believe that that is the mosque that Muhammad visited. So again, it all kind of gets muddled as to when something happened. So when the Templars, coming back to the Knights of the Temple, when they were there, this was their headquarters. Their headquarters was in the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And, it was supposedly where God gathered the dust to create Adam, the Temple of Solomon, Ark of the Covenant. It's referred to several times in both the Old and New Testament. So like that story about where Jesus chased away the money changers, that was at the Temple of Solomon. And this is the story that I was telling you about the Isra and Miraj. And there's so much beautiful, beautiful Islamic art about this, about the story of Muhammad being lifted up to heaven on the Burak. Yeah, I already showed you that. And then this is where the Knights Templar was set up. The mosque itself was built in 705, then the Crusaders captured it in 1099. The Templars were there from about 1119 to 1187. So nothing to do with the Priory of Sion. There's no Priory of Sion here so far. All right. So this idea of the warrior monk, as I said, was very, very controversial at the time. There were people in Europe who believed that it was wrong for a monk to bear arms, even if they were doing it in a good cause. But there was a very powerful churchman at the time, Bernard, now Saint Bernard. He founded the Cistercian order, and he strongly supported the Templars, and he wrote very, very persuasively on their behalf. He would say, "A Templar knight is truly a fearless knight and secure on every side, for his soul is protected by the armor of faith, just as his body is protected by the armor of steel. He is thus doubly armed and need fear neither demons nor men." And this was very persuasive, and other things that he wrote as well. And so he spoke at church councils about the Templars, and that was what got the Pope to come in and say, okay, the Templars, we will now give them the official approval of the church, the official approval of the Pope. And that was at the Council of Troyes in 1129. That's when they became a favored charity. And they had very strict rules about how the Templars were supposed to act. They had to wear these white robes. They had to wear them all the time. Even they could not eat unless they were wearing the robes. So it was like a brand. They were very, very recognizable wherever they were. They also had to take vows of piety, charity, chastity. They were not allowed to touch women, even members of their own family. They had to stay completely separate at all times. And they were respected. There were exceptions here and there, but in general they were respected both by the Christians and by the Muslims. The Muslims had great respect for the Templars as well, and the Templars tended to have great respect for the Muslims as well. Many Templars learned how to speak with the Muslims, and you know, they would get together in diplomatic missions and would speak together very respectfully. It wasn't always a combative role, but when there were battles, the Templars, they would usually be on the front line. So you might have the Muslim army here and the Christian army here, and then in front there would be a line of horses with Templars on them. And these guys, they were funded. Okay, they had armor. They had big war horses. They were well trained, and they didn't care if they died in battle. And this line of Templars would just charge, just as a wedge, charging at the other side army, and you'd see these guys coming at you and you would kind of part. And that would be one way that the Christian army would then come in and start the battle. So the Muslims had great respect for the Templars. The Templars also, one of their rules was they weren't allowed to retreat from battle. As long as the Templar flag was flying, they were required to keep fighting. If their flag fell, they were supposed to try and regroup with one of the other military orders, such as the Teutonic Knights or the Knights of the Hospital, Knights Hospitalet. And it was only after all those flags had fallen that a Templar might be allowed to retreat. This was Pope Innocent in 1139. He gave the Templars even more power. He said that they were exempt from local laws, so that if the Templars were trying to get to the Holy Land or coming back, they didn't have to stop at each border and pay taxes and deal with whoever was in charge of that particular area. Pope Innocent said they're immune. They can go through any border. They're not subject to local laws. They're only subject to me, the Pope. And so they paid no taxes anywhere. And so then this, again, helped make them more powerful. But it also started making some nobles a little bit nervous, because you have this free army that is not subject to any authority, only subject to the Pope, that is passing back and forth through all borders, is not paying any taxes to the local noble. And so some friction was starting around there. Divisions in the Templars, we had knights, and they had to be from knightly descent. They had to be born into noble families, and they were the ones that wore the white robes. And there were also Templars that would wear black or brown robes. Those would be the sergeants and craftsmen. And then there was another section of the Templars. Those were the clergy that would work for the religious needs of the knights, since they were a monastic order. I'll tell you about that. Okay. Then the order of the knights, they would have masters in each region, and then there would be a grand master over the entire organization. It was a lifetime appointment, but that could often be a very short tenure because the grand masters were often, they were out there in battle as well, and there were many grand masters that were killed in battle. So other things that the Templars did, if you've been to London and you've seen the Temple Church, this was built by the Templars. Pretty much anything with the word temple in it, like the Temple subway station, is based on the Templars. And they built these round buildings, which were not related to astronomy or anything. They were based on the buildings that were in Jerusalem, such as the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which was round. And so the Templars would build that in honor of the structures that were in Jerusalem. They had an initiation ceremony, and it was a secret ceremony. This is another thing that started causing some friction. They would take these vows of chastity, piety, poverty, and obedience. But again, anyone that wanted to say something bad about the Templars, anyone who was kind of anti-authority, they could use that. What are they doing, these secret ceremonies? And they could kind of make things up from there. There's a picture of the Temple Tube Station. They also originated the idea of letters of credit and banking, and this was again to protect the pilgrims that were going from Europe down to Jerusalem. If a pilgrim had to be carrying their wealth with them, they didn't have credit cards. So what the Templars did is come up with this idea of a letter of credit. So the pilgrim would start in Europe, would give their wealth to the Templars, and would get a letter, and then the pilgrim would travel to Jerusalem, and then they'd present the letter there, and then they'd be able to get money from the Templars that were there. It was really kind of the first form of checking. Many battles that the Templars were in. This is one of the most pivotal battles in the Crusades. This was the Battle of the Horns of Hattin in 1187. And this is where the Crusaders really lost Jerusalem at this battle. And it was the Templars' fault to some degree. The Grand Master of the Templars at that time was not a brilliant military strategist. And he made several errors, such as not making sure that the troops had enough water, not camping near water, setting up a battle on a hot desert day, and the Muslim side, such as Saladin, who was a brilliant man, very well respected, I would have loved to have met him, he took advantage of all these mistakes that the Christians were making. So they would they knew that the people didn't have water, so upwind they'd start fires, so smoke is blowing into people's eyes. They knew that the Christians were not rested because they weren't sleeping well, so the Muslims were well rested. So when the battle finally happened, 1187, it was really a slaughter. The Muslims really just routed. And then Jerusalem fell very shortly after that and went back into Muslim control. It went back and forth over the next couple hundred years, but the Christians never really regained full control after that. So Jerusalem lost in 1187. When Jerusalem was lost, the Templars, since they were no longer allowed to have their headquarters in Jerusalem, they retreated to the city of Acre, which was on the coast. And they were there for about 100 years until Acre fell as well, and then they retreated further north and then finally retreated to the island of Cyprus. Jerusalem was first taken around 1099. Now we're fast forward about 200 years. Crusades are not so exciting in Europe anymore. People aren't as excited in donating money to a charity that's just losing battle after battle after battle. And so there's starting to be rumblings about what are these Templars and why aren't they paying any taxes. King Philip in France, he had been borrowing money from the Templars because he wanted to finance his own wars with the British. And he was hugely, hugely in debt to the Templars. And so he was thinking, how can he get out of debt? And he thought, okay, I'll get them disbanded. And then if they're disbanded, I won't have to pay back my loan. So he was really the instigator there. And he was always in battles, not only with the Templars, but also with the Pope. So like a couple popes before this whole thing with the Templars happened, there'd been a Pope, Boniface VIII, and he'd been objecting and arguing with Philip because the Pope was saying Pope above King, and Philip was saying no, King above Pope. And they were arguing about this stuff, and so then Philip kind of pushed the matter and had the Pope kidnapped. And he had the Pope charged with heresy. He had the Pope charged with urinating on the cross. He had the Pope charged with all this, and this was an elderly Pope. And the people in Italy, they rose up and they rescued the Pope, but he was kind of an elderly guy, and he died about a month later. So the cardinals come in, they go into conclave, they choose another Pope, Benedict XI, who only lasts about a few months, and then he dies, probably poisoned by someone working for Philip, maybe at Dinogore. So then the cardinals get together again and say, okay, we have to pick a new Pope. Who are we going to pick? They take a year. They're in conclave for a year trying to decide who they're going to choose as the next pope. They finally choose a man who becomes Pope Clement V, and this man is a Frenchman. He was a childhood friend of Philip's. And Clement also moves the entire papacy from Italy to France. So if you've ever heard of this thing called the Avignon papacy, the captivity, that's what was going on there. So it's you hear these bits and pieces and all kind of comes together. And that was Pope Clement. All right. So Pope Clement was very much under Philip's thumb, bullied a lot, and wouldn't just disband them, though. I mean, he had a certain amount of independence. But Philip continued to push the matter. So on October 13, 1307, Philip had sent out secret orders to all of his agents in France saying, on this morning, arrest every Templar you can find and seize their treasure. And it was a dawn raid. It was very dramatic, and it happened. To give it like a modern equivalent, it's sort of like if everyone woke up one morning and we opened, you know, the news and it said everyone in Microsoft has been arrested this morning by some king, you know, in Denmark or something. It was this huge organization that was trusted and was handling money, and they owned vineyards, and they had their own fleet of ships, and suddenly every single one of them in France is arrested and charged with heresy and urinating on the cross and doing blasphemous things. It's the exact same charges that Philip had earlier been leveling against that other inconvenient pope. So it was pretty obviously trumped up charges. Some of the Templars confessed, but it was confessions under torture, really, really nasty torture. Putting fire to someone's feet until the bones would show. I mean, really ugly, ugly stuff. And some of the Templars did confess, you know, under that kind of torture, and then Philip would use those confessions. But some of them still kind of wanted to defend themselves, and the Pope was trying to get in there to help the Templars as well, and it was a messy political thing. But continuing with this influence from Philip, the Pope said on November 22nd, he issued, it's called a papal bull, a Pastoralis Praementi, I'm probably bastardizing the pronunciation of that, but he said, not just in France, but arrest all Templars in Europe and seize their assets. Now, some nobles did this, and some said, no, we're not going to do it, this makes no sense. In Portugal, for example, the Templars there were simply allowed to change their name, they changed their company name, from Knights Templar to Orders of Christ, the Order of Christ. Same guys, just under a different name, and were allowed to continue on and do whatever it is that they wanted to do. Okay. In other places, there were nobles that arrested the Templars, tried them, found them innocent, let them go. But in France, you know, King Philip is continuing to say, no, we have these confessions, we have all of this going on. Some of the Templars actually had education, they had legal experience, and once the Pope got them kind of away from Philip, these Templars went forward and said, okay, we want to defend ourselves in the trials. And then Philip came up and said, no, you have a confession, we have a written confession, burn them. And so they burned these guys at the stake on an island in the middle of Paris. It was messy, brutal, brutal business. So finally we get to 1312, and Pope Clement, he does issue this order, Vox in Excelsio, telling everyone in Europe, disband the Templars, disband the Templars. But then he issues ad providam. He says, everything that the Templars owned, give it to the Knights Hospital. So King Philip was not able to get the treasure. The Pope did arrange that all of the wealth of the Templars went to another one of the military orders. So the last Grand Master, and there's so many stories about Jacques de Molay. He was the last Grand Master. He was one of the people that was arrested on that dawn raid in October 13, 1307. He was tortured, forced to confess his sins, and then he would recant, and then he would be forced to confess again, and then he would recant again. And he was an older guy, and this was going back and forth. And then finally, he just recanted, and he said, no, I will not go back. These charges are false. It didn't happen this way. And there was another man with him as well who rallied to him and agreed. He said, yes, I'm a senior Templar, and these things that Philip's saying are not true. So again, Philip said, burn them and put them on an island in the Seine. And it's, you know, some people say, why did he not just say, okay, don't burn me, fine, force confession. But I think he was just tired. He was an older guy. He'd been treated horribly. I think he just wanted it to be over at that point. According to legend, he was tied in such a way that his hands were together in prayer, and he was facing the Notre Dame Cathedral. Also, according to legend, and this isn't true, but it's a great story, is that he called out from the flames that soon both Philip, King Philip, and Pope Clement would meet him before God. And it is fact that both Philip and Clement died within a year. Philip was a young, vigorous guy and died in a hunting accident. And Clement, who hadn't been in the best of health anyway, but he also died as well. So it's a great story and a great legend that this grandmaster, this wronged grandmaster, calls this curse out. And not only that, but Philip, you know, he died, and then his son became king, and he died, and Philip had 4 sons. They all died. The entire line died out, okay, within a few years. And in France, they call it Les Rois Maudits, the accursed kings. There's actually a mini-series that's going on about the whole story, and I'm trying to get copies of that, because there was a series of books and then a series of television shows, and it's a big part of the French culture. Les Rois Maudits. Okay. Okay. So what happened to the rest of the Templars? Some were tried. Virtually none of them were convicted. Many were just allowed to retire and pensioned off. Some of them would just change their jobs. Instead of being Templars, they became Knights of the Hospital or the Teutonic Knights. Like I said, in Portugal, they just changed their name over to the Order of Christ. This is a picture of the Castle Tomar in northern Portugal. Again, we have the round structure. It's a UNESCO World Heritage Site, well worth visiting. So, getting back to fact and fiction. So this idea of King Philip with Friday, October 13, 1307, which was a Friday, is that the origin of the Friday the 13th story? No, it is not, despite Dan Brown saying so. The actual concept of Friday the 13th didn't really start until late 1800s or so. And what it was now, and the reason I say that we know that it doesn't go back to 1307 is because there are academics through the centuries that track superstitions and myths and stories. And you can look into books of folklore, and it'll say Friday, unlucky day, 13, unlucky number. But there's no concept of Friday the 13th until late 1800s, early 1900s. And I think there was one author who mentioned it in the 1800s, but it really came into popular use in the early 1900s because there was a politician somewhere who did something really stupid, and the newspapers the next day were saying, how stupid can you be doing something on a Friday the 13th? And that's where the two really got linked, and then it kind of grew from there. Okay. Baphomet, which again, you'll see these people, the Templars worshiping. It has a very, very faint connection to the trials because the name Baphomet does appear in some of the trial documents. So some people who aren't doing their research will say, but oh, they were worshiping a demon. No, what modern scholars believe is that Baphomet was a misspelling of the name Muhammad. And the inquisitors were kind of writing down what these tortured guys were saying, and they were trying to get these tortured guys to say that they had worshipped demons or done this, and along with the Templars were talking about their actual mission, which was to fight the Muslims who worship Muhammad, and that's kind of, it all kind of got mangled together. But then a man named, I think, Eliphas Levi, someone correct me if I'm wrong, drew this image of what he thought Baphomet would look like, this kind of Sabbatic goat image, and then that got linked to the idea of Baphomet, and then thing that got linked to the Templars, and now people are actually buying statues of this and thinking that it's related to the Templars, and it's not. Okay, so the Holy Grail, where did this come from? The Holy Grail was medieval fan fiction, okay? Right. And again, you look at historians writing, even through the Dark Ages, there is no mention of the Holy Grail at all. It's not like, well, it went to this place, and nothing. The first mention of the Holy Grail is in a poem that was written in the 12th century, 1180, by a monk named Chrétien de Troyes. And he'd written several stories. And one of the stories he wrote, and he never actually finished it, was Le Conte du Graal, the story of the Grail. And in the story of the Grail, you have Percival who's asking questions. He goes to a castle. And then there's this scene, and I'll say it in French and then in English. Une demoiselle très belle, élancée et bien parée, qui avec les valets venait, tenait un Graal entre ses mains. Quand on la salle, elle fut entrée avec le Graal qu'elle tenait. Une si grande lumière en vint que les chandelles ont perdu leur clarté comme les étoiles qu'on se lève soleil ou lune. And now English, which is not quite as poetic, but a beautiful girl, slender and well-dressed, came in with the servants, holding a grail in her hands. As she entered the room with the grail, which she held, such a great light came that the candles lost their brilliance, as do stars upon the rising of the moon or the sun. So it's a very evocative idea. What was she carrying? And in the Conte, they never really say what this is. The story was supposed to be that Percival, who had been kind of told stop asking so many questions, did not ask questions as this girl goes through the room. And there were other things. There was a man carrying a spear, and there was blood on the tip of the spear. And then afterwards, Percival, everything, all of it disappears, and Percival is told that he should have asked a question. And the question he should have asked actually was not what is the grail, but he should have asked, who does the grail serve? Where is she going with such a wonderful serving dish? And then the story was never finished, and it just sparked the imagination, an unfinished story. What is the grail? And thing, it started getting conflated with all sorts of other legends, like the cornucopia, you know, was in it, or maybe it was something that Jesus had touched, maybe, and then other people would write stories. These were continuous, sort of, again, fan fiction, sort of like Star Trek, the series is over, and people are continuing to write stories about what would the characters have done, what would have gone on, and so they keep expanding on the grail. Maybe the in one story, the grail is levitating, and another, food is coming out of the grail. Another, it's a holy relic, and it kind of grew and grew and grew. And today, the Holy Grail has this image of, well, it was something, it was the cup that Jesus used at the Last Supper, and maybe Leonardo da Vinci put an image of the Holy Grail, hid an image there, or maybe the Holy Grail is a symbolic image, meaning Mary Magdalene had a relationship with Jesus, and you know, she was the grail, and to hold a child based on the Jesus bloodline. So it just kind of keeps growing and growing, and it really all kind of came from this kind of mysterious, what is the grail? So, Rosalind Chapel is another thing that's associated with the Templars, and it was not constructed at the time of the Templars. It was constructed about 100, 150 years later. It does have some Templar imagery in there. The Templar cross is the image of the Templar seal, two impoverished knights on a single horse, and it has some images of Freemasonry as well. I personally don't think that it's got secret messages and it's trying to portray anything in particular. I think whoever built it was just very interested in all these kinds of stories, and they were trying to claim heritage for themselves from Templar, saying, you know, my great-grandfather was a Templar, my great-grandfather helped finance the Templars, and putting all of this information into the building. Okay. Now, Freemasonry, which would be a whole other story, that kind of emerged in the 1700s, and it's another thing that kind of gets merged with the Templars, and people kind of lose track of when the Templars ended in the early 1300s, and when Freemasonry emerged in the early 1700s. Freemasonry, again, they also kind of wanted to add to their mystique and claim some heritage from older things. Like people here at DragonCon will wander around wearing druidic costumes or medieval costumes, and it doesn't mean that they're trying to portray a secret message or anything. It just means that they're inspired by the stories that came from hundreds of years earlier. And so the Freemasons had this as well. They were inspired by the idea of these Templars, the society that was persecuted and disappeared very rapidly. So the Freemasons set up some Templar names and rituals in the Freemason rituals, such as there's an order of Jacques de Molay, and then they also started in Freemasonry rituals, they would say things about the Temple of Solomon and the building of all that, and so it all kind of started getting mushed together. Now, the Shroud of Turin actually does have an interesting link. Now, I'm not saying that it is the burial shroud of Jesus. What I believe is known about the Shroud of Turin is that the first time it publicly came to light was in the 14th century, in 1357. And the family that owned it at that time was the family of the grandson of Geoffrey de Charnay. So when I mentioned that Jacques de Molay was recanting and saying, this is lies, the Templars are a good organization, and I mentioned another man came and rallied to him, that was Geoffrey de Charnay. So, and Geoffrey de Charnay was the other man who was burned at the stake next to Jacques de Molay. So after this, many years later, the grandson of Geoffrey de Charnay, I believe he died, and then his widow was the one that said, here is something from our family, and that was the Shroud of Turin. She publicly displayed it in a church. So it does sort of have a connection with the Templars. The Templars were known to collect relics, and relics are not unusual anywhere in Christianity or Catholicism. You go somewhere and they have, you know, the finger bone of this saint here, or the skull, or a robe that was carried by some other saint, or anything that's connected with a saint, even if it's like bits of dirt from the grave of a saint, has great significance within the religion. And when the Templars would run across something that they believe was part of the true cross, or they had the head of another saint, it sounds kind of bizarre and zombie-ish to collect the head of a dead person, but it within the religion it was considered the proper thing to do. And they had the shroud. Now maybe they believed it was a relic, maybe they collected it because it might be a relic and that they were investigating it, I don't know. My own personal theory is that the shroud was painted in an unusual way, but that it was a flag. Like you go into battle and someone will be holding a staff with a banner hanging on both sides, and you'll see a figure on one side and you'll see a figure on the other, and that's what the shroud is. As for how it was created, I don't have any strong opinions on that. This is what I was talking about with the Prior of Sion, now in reality. So it was a hoax founded in 1956 by Pierre Plantard. He forged documents. Some of the documents were planted in the French National Library. Some of them were planted in a book about Rennes le Château. This is that book, Le Trésor Maudit de Rennes le Château, The Accursed Treasure of Rennes le Château. Rennes le Château, tiny, tiny little village in the south of France, permanent population like about 150, I mean really small. And it's just has this mystique about it. And this mystique really started in the 20th century from a restaurant owner named Noël Corbeau. And Corbeau had bought the building that used to belong to a priest named Berenger Saunière, and Corbeau wanted to turn it into a restaurant, a hotel, a bed and breakfast. But Rennes le Château is way out in the middle of nowhere, and he wasn't getting enough business. So anyone here who's run a hotel and you're not getting business, what do you do if you want to get business? You create a story about a ghost, or you create a story about a buried treasure. And then people start coming and they want to stay at the hotel because they want to see, you know, find out if there was a ghost there, or they want to go and look for the buried treasure. So Noël Corbeau had heard that Berenger Saunière had come into a lot of money. This is true. Berenger Saunière was a poor priest who came into a lot of money. And the townspeople were like, well, you know, where did his money come from? Where did his money come from? So Corbeau kind of expanded on this. Well, Saunière, he had money. He must have had a secret treasure. He must have buried this treasure around here somewhere. Maybe he had a secret of some sort about the church, and so the church was paying him money to keep the secret quiet. And with the townspeople, the story just kind of grew and grew and grew. Okay, so with all these stories, Pierre Plantard heard these stories about hidden treasure and everything else going on around Rennes le Château, and that's when he came to Rennes le Château, and that's when he did his story about Le Trésor Maudit, that maybe what Saunière had done, and here's where we're going way off into fiction, that Saunière had been renovating his church, and as he'd opened up one of the pillars to move it, that he'd found inside the pillar medieval documents. And these medieval documents prove the existence of a Priory of Sion. And this Priory of Sion had been guarding a secret, had founded the Knights Templar, had been run by Leonardo da Vinci, and all of these things. So he was just building on the stories that Corbeau had done. Right. Then, after Le Trésor Maudit came along, Henry Lincoln, who was a British scriptwriter, had written some Doctor Who stories in England. So he's on vacation in England, and he goes in and he reads Le Trésor Maudit, and he's fascinated by this idea of hidden treasure, and he sees what looks like these medieval documents that are reprinted in the book. And some of these documents seem to have encrypted messages in the documents, like little letters are raised here and there. This is true. The documents do have this, the forged documents. And one of the messages, if you take all the raised letters, it says, A Dagobert du Roi et à Sion et ce trésor et il est la mort. To King Dagobert II and to Sion does this treasure belong, and it is death, or and he is there dead, depending on how you translate it. So who's King Dagobert II? And here's where we're going towards Da Vinci Code now. How did Dan Brown get involved in this? King Dagobert II was the last of the kings of the Merovingians. It was a French line of kings, died out in the 7th century. The last king was assassinated. So this was another mystery in France. Where did the Merovingian treasure go? So they were trying now to connect the Merovingian treasure with Berenger Saunière's treasure, with Pierre Plantard's hoax, and connect it all together and try to give it some sort of a modern relevance. Here's one of the documents that was reprinted in the book. So it looks like a medieval document. It's not a medieval document. It's a forgery that was created by Pierre Plantard and put into the book. And if you look at the document carefully, you'll see certain letters are raised a little bit. So you have a M here and a T here. You have an A here. So and then you have PS, which was meant to refer to Priory of Sion. And Henry Lincoln was very excited when he saw this because he thought he'd found something that no one else had found. So Henry Lincoln goes back to England. He goes to BBC and he pitches and says, "Hey, I want to do a documentary on Rennes-le-Château." And BBC, I think it was BBC 4, says okay on it. And Henry Lincoln writes a series of documentaries about Rennes-le-Château. And so now he's writing about the secret treasure and the Merovingian and the Priory of Sion. And when he runs out of source material, he just starts adding more source material onto it. Okay, and you know, for example, he looks at the area around Rennes-le-Château and sees there's a mountain here and a mountain here and a mountain here. And if you draw points between the mountains, you can make a pentagram. And there's a building over there. So and it must have been built by the Knights Templar to do secret astronomical observations because they were communicating with aliens. And it just grows and grows and grows and grows. And so then Henry Lincoln, he's on the lecture circuit. This is a popular stuff going on. And while on the lecture circuit, Henry Lincoln meets up with two other guys who are sort of anti-authority and anti-church. And these are the guys that are Bagent and Lee. And so the three of them, they get along really well. They're talking. They got, well, what about, oh, yeah, that's probably true. Oh, yeah. And then they go back and forth and expand it. And they're going on the lecture circuit and telling more and more stories as they go. So do that. All right. Okay, so then they start researching more and more, and they start thinking about, okay, this treasure. Where did the treasure come from? Well, Merovingians, and how can we connect this with the church? And Merovingians, well, who was the first Merovingian king? And this is reality. The first Merovingian king was a guy named Merowig, around the 5th century or so. And there's not a whole lot known about Merowig, just various legends. And one of the legends is that Merowig was the son of a sea serpent, because his mother had gone swimming and had encountered a sea serpent, they had carnal relations, and that's where Merowig came from. Yeah, it's fine. Okay, that's how you start a line of kings in France. Okay. So we have Bagent and Lee and Lincoln, and they're sitting in a hotel room and thinking, okay, how can we do this? So what does this have to do with Christianity? And how? So Merowig, well, he was born, it was something's fishy about this. And then they were thinking, well, but wait, you know, early Christians, they used the symbol of a fish. That was like one of their secret symbols that they would use to communicate with each other. So if Christians used a symbol of a fish, that must mean that Merowig was descended from Jesus Christ. Oh, and then that goes into the lecture circuit and goes added on. And then that's really popular in the lecture circuit as well, and they keep expanding and expanding. And then they run into Pierre Plantard, who does not tell them that he is a hoaxer. He tells them that he has information about the Priory of Sion, and he points them to the French National Library, where Plantard knows he has planted forged documents in the National Library. So Bagent and Lee and Lincoln go to the National Library, find these documents about the Priory of Sion, feel they've made this great discovery, start writing about that in Holy Blood, Holy Grail. So Holy Blood, Holy Grail comes out in 1982. Huge bestseller. Fascinating stuff, but based on hoax upon lie, upon speculation, upon mystery, just kind of growing and growing. So the chain of speculation, we'll go to Rennes-le-Château, 1956, Noël Corbeau, he starts rumors about a hidden treasure. 1967, Plantard and Desaid, they published Le Trésor Maudit with false documents to confirm this treasure and tie it to their own hoax of Priory of Sion. 1969, Henry Lincoln, the Doctor Who screenwriter, reads this, finds the Sion reference, and starts creating books and documentaries about it. 1982, Lincoln, Bagent, and Lee take this and publish Holy Blood, Holy Grail, saying Priory of Sion is a fact. Priory of Sion is a fact. 2003, Dan Brown writes The Da Vinci Code, saying Priory of Sion is a fact. And it just kind of all boils, you know, kind of goes around. And this kind of thing has happened many, many times in the past. It's not just about the Priory of Sion, but even during the Crusades, things would happen. As I showed you that grand painting about the taking of Jerusalem by Jacques de Molay, which never happened. People find things that they want to believe that are interesting stories, and they add on that. And also historians who don't really do their research. So, for example, Mongol Empire really existed. Mongols really existed. And there was a Mongol general named Muley. Mulay, M-U-L-A-Y would be the easiest way we'd probably write it. And some of the European historians at the time wrote about this general Mulay. Modern historians, 1800s, 1900s, saw Mulay, never heard of him, think, oh, they must mean Jacques de Molay. And they would then write, well, Jacques de Molay was a general in charge of a Mongol division. Didn't happen. They just got the names confused. And then a playwright came across this idea, loved the idea of Jacques de Molay in charge of a Mongol division, and added, oh yeah, he was in charge of a Mongol division, and they captured Jerusalem. Great story. French king loves the story, and we end up with this huge painting in the Hall of Crusades. Jacques de Molay takes Jerusalem, 1299. Didn't happen, okay? Didn't happen. Right. So anyone who really does want to learn more about the Templars, the number one books I would recommend by Malcolm Barber, there's a book called The New Knighthood. He is like the number one scholar on the Templars. He also wrote a book called The Trial of the Templars, where he goes into great detail about the documents, and he's, I've met him, and he's a very thorough, detail-oriented scholar, very serious. Helen Nicholson also wrote a wonderful book called The Knights Templar, A New History. But it's just as a quick rule of thumb, if you're in a bookstore and you're looking for a book on the Templars and you're not sure whether or not it's a good book, pick up the book, look on the back. If it says anything about UFOs, space aliens, put the book back on the shelf. Okay. So, Templars and Space Aliens, anything about Templars reconquering Jerusalem in 1300, Templars in charge of the Mongol Army, in charge of the Mongol army, put the book back on the shelf. So, summary. Knights Templar, real organization, did exist, 1119 to 1312, very influential, very well known, not like the secret society that no one had heard of. Everyone had heard of the Templars. They were like the world's first multinational corporation. They were persecuted by King Philip IV in France, who did request dawn raid October 13, 1307. The date is correct. The idea that that's the origin of Friday the 13th is not. Templars have had a massive impact on modern culture, both from the buildings we see to the legends that continue to be told. It's a very compelling story, and people love taking that story and then adding a little bit more and a little bit more and a little bit more. But try and keep focused on what the actual reality is of the Templars. Okay, questions? Yes. Okay, so the question is, she's been to Israel, went to the city of Acre, and has seen excavations that have been going on about where the Templars were, and she's asking about, are there any other areas that are being excavated that were Templar sites? And I would say yes, there's lots. I mean, there's ruins of Crusader castles all up and down Palestine. Probably the most famous ones are on the Temple Mount. There were areas where the Templars, they had to stable their horses. And this was some interesting structures because it was on the Temple Mount. It had been the Temple of Solomon. Then the Muslims repurposed it. Then the Templars repurposed it. Then the Muslims repurposed it again. So you can go there and you can see bits and pieces of all sorts of different cultures going on. But and this adds to the stories as well, because someone could go there and they could find a cup and they could say, ah, this is the Holy Grail, and obviously the Templars hid it here. Well, no, there was a lot of other stuff going on there. There's many reasons for there to be a cup anywhere in the Temple Mount. Okay.
I had heard a rumor a few years back that some of the Knights Templars that had managed to escape being persecuted went to Scotland and were involved with the Jacobite Rebellion. Has that been substantiated at all?
Yeah, it is one of the interesting stories. And it's very possible that Templars did go to Scotland. I mean, they were in basically a corporation that had been disbanded, and some of them probably did go to other countries. As for whether they went there and reconstituted a Templar order, there may have been some clubs, you know, like the Kiwanis sites, or, you know, the Rotary clubs, you know, Foreign Legion, you know, veterans of foreign wars. That's very possible there. Some people think, well, the Templars there, and then there are descendants of modern Templars. But there's a logical flaw there, which is Templars took vows of chastity. They had no children. So there cannot have been descendants of Templars. There can be people who descended from families that had Templars in them. That's very possible. And I think that's what happened with Roslyn Chapel. Another interesting story is in Switzerland. Some people talk about, well, maybe the Templars escaped to Switzerland and set up what is today the modern banking organization with the Swiss banks. And it's a very interesting and compelling story. I'm not aware of any evidence that it's true, but it's a very interesting and compelling story. Another one is about, there was a Swiss village that was having a battle, and very suddenly the villagers suddenly had great knowledge about battle tactics, and they could set up ambushes and traps and things, and someone wondered, did Templars go there and teach them this? And it's possible. people, but there's also a lot of crusaders that were coming back that may have had this knowledge as well. So again, we have no proof that it was Templars, but it's always easy to kind of hang these stories on the Templar hook because it just kind of adds to the mystique. Okay.
Whatever happened to the Order of Christ?
The Order of Christ, I believe, is still around. They may have changed their name again. And in Portugal, actually, some of the Templar orders morphed into orders that continued to go into seafaring. And so the navigators, so the family of Henry the Navigator and even the navigator on Columbus's ships as well, sort of had a link to all of this with the Order of Christ and the Templars.
So would you say that it would not be Dan Brown's fault that he was full of shit in the Da Vinci Code?
I think
the research is always the writer's fault.
Yeah. I think Dan Brown is a fun guy who came from a very good family and tried various careers that didn't work out. Like, originally he wanted to be a songwriter. He was living in L.A. He was a member of the National Academy of Songwriters. That's where he met Blythe, who later became his wife. She was trying to promote his music business. It never really took off, but you can find some of his CDs on the web if you go and look around. And then he moved back home, or where he grew up, with Blythe, and then he started writing books. And his first three books all kind of sank without a trace. None of them had more than 10,000 copies. And then he wrote this book called The Da Vinci Code. And Da Vinci Code took off, hit bestseller immediately, and dragged his other three books, Angels and Demons, Deception Point, Digital Fortress, all up onto the bestseller, such that all four of them were on the New York Times bestseller list at the same time. But it was all because of Da Vinci Code. And So I think he really set out to write a book that would sell. He wanted to write a book that would raise questions in people's minds. Also, it's coming from his own childhood to some degree. His father is a mathematics teacher and actually wrote an award-winning mathematics textbook. And when Dan Brown was a kid, for him and his siblings, like for Christmas, the presents would not just be under the tree. There'd be like a clue under the tree. And then the kids would have to go and follow that clue to somewhere else, like, where do gummy bears hide or something. And then they'd find another clue, and then find another clue, and that would lead them to their Christmas presents. That was just a tradition that they had in their family. And so I think that kind of idea of a treasure hunt, go here, find a clue, is very much what he's got in Da Vinci Code and again in Lost Symbol. You go to a place, you get a clue, which takes you to somewhere else where you get another clue. So it all kind of comes back to his childhood.
So do we want to send him an audio recording of this?
I think this has already been written about him many, many times. And he said some of this about himself as well.
Hi there, I'm next.
Hi.
Have you found any connection between the Knights of St. John and the Knights Templar?
I think the Knights of St. John is sometimes another name for the Knights Hospital, I believe, and Knights of Malta, they all kind of have different names, so I think that's the main connection.
Could you put the book recommendations back up on the screen?
Which one?
The book recommendations.
Oh, sure.
And how were those documents shown to be forgeries? Was it internal evidence, or was it forensic analysis, or did they confess?
They confessed. There were court rulings, and Pierre Plantard was in court, admitted it was a forgery, said they actually showed the original documents that were forgeries. 60 Minutes did a whole segment on it and traced down the information and talked to a guy who was showing them the forgeries. But even though this has all been debunked thoroughly, people still want to believe in it. And
did Dan Brown know that?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And Ed Bradley, the late Ed Bradley, had a wonderful quote, which is that they found out where Béranger Saunier, where his money really came from. It wasn't a great treasure. He was selling masses. And people would send him one franc in order to say a mass. And then he would promise many more masses than he could actually say. He became kind of well known in France, and people were sending him lots of money to say masses, which he wasn't actually saying. So Ed Bradley had this great quote saying, "The source of Father Béranger Saunier's wealth was not some miraculous treasure, but good old-fashioned fraud." Okay.
I have no idea if this is true or not, but you just mentioned the Knights of Malta, uh-huh. And I've heard supposedly that they are or were tied to the Knights Templar, mm-hmm. and such, and so I was wondering if there's any connection between the two, if mm-hmm. they actually exist, and there are various conspiracies associated with the Knights of Malta, and I was wondering if you could comment on that.
Sure. at the end of the Crusades, the three main military orders were the Knights Templar, the Knights of the Hospital, and the Teutonic Knights. And as they were being kind of driven off the continent and they were setting up their own bases of operations, the Knights of the Hospital owned the island of Malta. And that's where they set up their base of operations. So that's where they became the Knights of Malta. The Templars, they retreated to Cyprus, but they were looking into setting up their own base of operations, maybe somewhere in southern France in an area called the Languedoc, which was another thing that was causing conflict with King Philip. He didn't like the idea of people setting up their own nation nearby. And then the Teutonic Knights, I think they were on the island of Rhodes. But after the Templars were disbanded, all of their remaining assets and resources were handed over to the Knights of the Hospital, Knights of Malta. And so that was their connection. They controlled the Templar assets after the Templars were disbanded, and all of their documentation. And then a great deal of that was lost when the Muslims, again, as they were proceeding, or was it the Ottomans, went and took over the island of Cyprus. And then during the battles there, a great deal of information was lost. And treasure is a funny thing. People think, oh, well, there's a treasure and it'll be saved for future generations. But treasure doesn't work like that. Treasure gets spent. You know, people aren't going to say, oh, I'll save this for my grandchildren, my great-grandchildren. No, if they have a war, they go into the treasure vault and they get what they need to spend the money. So treasure tends not to stick around very long.
Was De Chrétien married before he became a knight? Because one of the slides said his grandson.
Oh, De Charnay?
De Charnay.
Yeah, and some Templars were allowed to get married. What they would do is that they wouldn't join the order for life. They would have like a regular wife, they'd have a wife, they'd have children, and then they would join the order for like a certain period of time during which they had to follow the order, you know, the directions, and then they would leave the order. It was sort of like going into military service. They'd go in for a few years and then they would come out.
My question is actually back to something that you mentioned at the very, very beginning, because we're a little over time, so I figure I can be off topic now. Have you been working on the third Kryptos, I believe is how it was said, at the CIA?
Oh, yeah, and I can give a long talk about this. Yeah, Kryptos, there's four codes on it. Three of the four have been solved. Fourth hasn't been solved yet. And Dan Brown, that was one of the things I was helping him with, was how to maybe use that fourth section of Kryptos as a tie-in to his book, especially the third part of Kryptos, decrypted to a quote by archaeologist Howard Carter about the discovery of King Tutankhamun's tomb, slowly, the remains of passage debris that encumbered the upper part of the doorway was removed. And it goes on, and again, a very evocative story, and Dan Brown was looking in the idea of pyramids and trying to tie this whole idea of maybe this King Tut quote on Kryptos had something to do with the pyramids. And when I was chatting with him and I was saying King Tut wasn't buried in a pyramid, King Tut was like buried over in the Valley of the Kings, and so and he rewrote it.
I just had a real quick question. The idea that is part of Dan Brown's book, which really seemed to make a lot of people sit up and take notice, was the idea of Jesus marrying Mary Magdalene and the myth of an unwed 30-year-old Jewish man wandering the desert. Mm-hmm. Has work been done on that to perhaps make that more welcome?
And it's not new with Holy Blood, Holy Grail. It's actually an idea that's been coming up for many hundreds of years, the idea of did Jesus have a child? Because not that much is known about him, about parts of his life. We kind of know when he was born, and we know when he was ministering, and there's a lot of other gaps that are in there. So it's possible that he had a wife. We just have no proof that he had a wife. And so some people, as I said, we have point A and point B, and then people kind of fill in the gap with whatever they want. So we can't say for sure that it didn't happen, no.
One thing I noticed, it jumped out immediately as soon as you said it. The priory documents had letters that were offset that actually turned out to be a message. Well, so does Kryptos. Mm-hmm. And so there's quite a bit of speculation as to whether or not that is a key or information. Did Dan Brown run with that connection?
Oh, with the letters out of alignment?
Yeah.
No, he didn't. Kryptos was kind of referred to in a couple places, only in terms of the text, the plain text of Kryptos. And then Dan Brown also wove in some stuff about 2012 with some of the crypto stuff. It has nothing to do with it, but he embedded a number. And I was like, why did he associate this number? And I went in, I did research, and I'm like, the number decodes to December 21st, 2012. And I just thought it was clever of Dan to do it. And he likes putting little codes. Before the Lost Symbol came out, Dan actually sent an email to me in code that used it used a magic square code, and I actually almost lost it in the spam because it was like, what's this garbled text? And I said, oh, from danbrown.com. I better read this. Okay. And when it decrypted to the message, Nola K saves day. So it was a clue that he was giving me before the book came out that he'd actually named a character after me in the book. By the way, also after The Lost Symbol came out, we have this book came out, which is Secrets of the Lost Symbol, which is myself and several other academics who are writing about the information in Lost Symbol and picking apart the fact and fiction, talking about what Brown got right, what he got wrong, especially what he got wrong. So I have two articles in here. One is about Kryptos and one is an interview with Jim Sanborn, the artist who created Kryptos, who's talking about his own opinions about Dan Brown's use of his work. And then I also hit a code on the dedication page if anyone kind of just wants to play with that. So.
And also, I might like to point out, she has this really awesome cryptography book. So if anybody has any desire to learn about cryptography or likes puzzles, that is an awesome book. And it's what you call a desert island book. Everything you need to do it is in that book.
Yeah, I wrote it. I call it my airplane style because I hate when I have a puzzle book and I'm on a plane and it says, oh, to proceed with this, just go look up in a dictionary. And you don't have a dictionary. You're at 30,000 feet. And I hate that. So everything that you need to solve the puzzles in this book is in the book. All the charts that you need. It's probably about 500 puzzles and information about how to solve all the different kinds of puzzles. And then after those, I do have a section on the world's most famous unsolved codes. And I'm not sure that you have the information you need in this book because no one solved them. So we don't know exactly what is needed at this point. Yeah, it's in its sixth printing and it's about to go into a second edition.
And what's really cool is it starts out with the basics of cryptography and builds on that toward as it gets more and more difficult puzzles through the book. So it's just a lot of fun. And having done cryptography, it like sucked me into the vortex. It was like awesome. I still, every once in a while, I'll break it out and start playing with it again. So
that's nice to hear.
Consumes time like nothing I've ever had before.
One other link between Dan Brown and cryptography was Dan Brown was sued by the authors of Holy Blood, Holy Grail, who were charging that he'd stolen their ideas. It went to court in England. Dan Brown won the case, but an interesting postscript is that the judge in the case, Justice Peter Smith, when he wrote the trial ruling, the 78-page trial ruling, the judge hid a code inside the trial ruling by italicizing certain letters. And when the London legal community heard about it, like the entire legal structure just ground to a halt because everybody was working, trying to find the code in this ruling and then trying to figure out what it said. So the Kryptos group, we were working on it as well. We were not the first to solve it. We did solve it. So if anyone had questions on that, it came out to say, Jackie Fisher, Who Are You, Dreadnought. And it was because Justice Peter Smith was a huge fan of British naval history. And the most famous admiral in British Navy is Nelson. Second most famous? Crickets, right. So the second most famous is Jackie Fisher. And the judge was always kind of upset about that. Jackie Fisher did many important things in the Navy. One of them was launching the ship known as the Dreadnought, which people have heard of the Dreadnought. And the 100-year anniversary of the launching of the Dreadnought was the same time as the Dan Brown trial. So to honor the centennial of this, the judge hid a code saying, Jackie Fisher, Who Are You, Dreadnought, and hid that in the trial ruling. So it was just a fun kind of story. All right. Yeah, Jackie Fisher, okay. Okay, all right. Any other questions so far? Yep, sure.
One more.
Yeah, and if anybody has to leave, feel free.
This is off topic, but as a code breaker, do you have any opinion on the I think it's the Voynich manuscript?
The Voynich manuscript. Yeah, I do maintain a list of the world's most famous unsolved codes.
Do you think it's code at all?
Voynich manuscript is definitely in the top five of mysteries. I think it's a hoax. I think it will never be solved. Just like the Beale ciphers, which were enciphered with the Declaration of Independence, there were three documents. One is solved, the other other two are not, and I believe that they will never be solved. It's just a hoax designed to kind of sell pamphlets in the 1800s. So just like we have urban legends and memes going around in email today, they had urban legends in the 1800s as well. They were just the same kind of people as we are. People love telling stories. Yeah. Any other questions? Okay. Oh, sure. Shall we call it, or did anyone else have it?
Have you heard of the Knights Templar organization?
Mm-hmm. There are several organizations today that call themselves Templars, absolutely. And they call themselves Templar. The Masonic organizations have chapters that are called Templars as well. They have no relationship to the medieval organization other than that they are also using the name.
Because I've heard from one of them that they want me to join them, and I'm like, well, is this real or is this some kind of a hoax?
I would, my advice is just to treat them like a local Rotary Club, and if you want to spend time with them, do. If they start asking you for money, I would say no.
Yeah. Well, the letter came from overseas. I'm sorry, I forgot which country it was, but the letter's...
Nigeria?
No, I want to say Netherlands or something.
Okay. There's a lot of hoaxsters out there. So, yeah. I mean, it's kind of a random email saying join our organization, I would treat with great suspicion.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
You.
Okay.
You're awesome.
Okay.
Any more questions?
Okay. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I don't suppose I could get a free copy of your book, could I?
That would be correct. And you don't even get a beer for that one. Last night we had a panel where when people asked questions, we'd give them a beer. So, but sorry, no beer.
Okay. How much are your books?
I'm selling these for the code book for $20 and the hardcover for $30, autographed. You can get them cheaper on Amazon. I always tell people that. But if you want an autographed copy, $20 and $30. Yep. Mm-hmm. Okay. Sure. Okay, so I guess we'll call it. So again, thank you for coming. Thank you for coming to Dragon Con and standing in line. And see you next year.